Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
You're listening to the New Statesman podcast. We talk about the latest development with the Oxford vaccine, and you ask us. We discuss the counterfactual of what would have happened if the Liberal Democrats hadn't backed a general election in December 2019. So we have just had the news that the Oxford vaccine preliminary results have been published. And it seems to be safe and induces basically the kind of immunological profile that you would want. This is a glimmer of good news, isn't it?
Yeah, and coupled with the other bit of good news about, I'm going to mispronounce it and every doctor who listens to this podcast is going to cancel their subscription, the positive news about a new protein trial that reduces the lethality of the novel coronavirus by 79%. That's in cases who have gone to hospital. So, you know, that is a huge... So taken together, they're both very early trials, but it's two very positive signs in the battle against the novel coronavirus.
Yeah, I think the chances of something like this working are really quite low. I think I heard 25% was the expected chance of success for this particular vaccine, and that's high. So I think it's really good news. And the only questions, I think, you know, now if it carries on going in the right direction and the rest of the testing means that it is a viable vaccine against coronavirus, sort of the next battleground, I think, for the sort of race to the vaccine issue is who gets to have the vaccine. Because I think there was a suggestion from Matt Hancock and the Department for Health that everyone in the UK would get it. But actually, you know, perhaps it will be more like it would be more sensible to have it more administered more like a flu vaccine for people who are most vulnerable in order to make sure that there's enough doses to go round. And if anyone hasn't read our cover story this week by Anjana Ahuja, she makes the point about the sort of potential for unfair distribution of vaccines, particularly in this world that we live in now with nationalist America-style hoarding of treatments and vaccine doses to try and prioritize your own country first. So I think that will probably be the next issue if it turns out that this vaccine is everything that it sounds like it is.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose before that, there is the big caveat that it's a good step in the right direction, but we still have no idea whether this will actually prevent COVID-19 or bad outcomes from COVID-19 in patients who actually have it. So we only know at this stage that it does prompt the antibody and T cell immune response in people who don't have the virus that you'd want to see. So it looks promising, but I suppose there are more steps and hurdles that it needs to clear. And it feels like hope is a bit dangerous almost. But but I agree that I think that in a scientific way, this is a huge story, but in a way there isn't a huge amount to say about it beyond that this could be huge and have seismic effects all across the world and like return us to normality. So it's huge, but there isn't loads to say. Where I think you're right, Anoush, is that the interesting thing is the kind of the international politics of it and who gets to have it. And I mean, the way we only on Thursday heard that Russia had been trying to obtain access to some of the details of the Oxford vaccine trials, that this is kind of a new terrain for a kind of international competition, and obviously a a frontier of potential like global espionage and like for all of the rhetoric of international cooperation. And I think the consensus basically that this has to be a global effort. Like if there is coronavirus in other parts of the world, other countries can't be confident that they'll ever be rid of it. So it does need to be a global response. But I think that like the competition and the way this is a valuable investment for governments, the cross-section of the national pride element and the more like practical economic impact of it means that we maybe haven't even anticipated the ways in which the politics of the vaccine will play out.
Yeah, because I think so one of the positive things if the Oxford trial is borne out and it is successful is that it is one of the schemes which will be widely distributed, right? The fears of vaccine nationalism are less acute, although obviously in terms of the very live US outbreak, it is palliative treatments that are going to be so important, and indeed the very live outbreak in India and Brazil. But I particularly single out the US because if the US can't get the pandemic under control, then a vaccine is great for the rest of us being able to live our lives. But in terms of the economic consequences of the coronavirus, many of those problems don't go away. But yeah, it's as you say, there's not very much to say other than, you know, it's two very positive news stories. Yeah, about the idea, you know, we may again actually just be able to, you know, rock up to, like, I don't know, a pub 5 minutes before kickoff and be able to actually get in and watch the game or whatever, right? Yeah, like, yeah, it's great.
If you've been enjoying our podcast and want to find out more about what we think and some of our colleagues too, then why not subscribe to The New Statesman? You can get 12 weeks for £12. Go to newstatesman.com/subscribe12.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
Very good, guys. This week we thought we would do another one of our beloved counterfactual questions, and so the question is, how would things be different if the Liberal Democrats hadn't conceded to the Conservatives' desire to hold a general election in December 2019? Anoush, what do you think?
I love this question because I remember at the time when what was the argument? I can't remember. Why were the Remainer parties wanting to have an early general election? Because I remember thinking that is the most ridiculous and stupid decision that you could possibly make if you want to try and further those political interests. And I really can't remember what was the reasoning for it. Was it to try and get in before some new deadline of leaving the EU? What was it?
So the reasoning, and yeah, obviously with the disclaimer that I was someone who was very pro this, and I actually think still am.
Right, okay.
Is that the 2017 Parliament had passed Boris Johnson's deal.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But it only passed it at second reading. And obviously, you know, like everyone, like you had all of those people being like, oh, you know, we're going to like install a requirement for him to like ask for a customs union in the next stage of, yeah, like, mm-hmm. you know, like we'll get some customs union language in like the political declaration or whatever. But the argument, I think there is somewhere on the NS website a piece where I sort of explicitly say this, the argument wasn't like, as unlikely as people may have thought it was, and I'm not going to pretend I didn't think it was a long shot, as unlikely as people may have thought it was, there was no route to preventing Brexit that did not run through trying to get a more anti-Brexit parliament than the 2017 mm-hmm. one, which, you know, I know that, like, bizarrely, like, one of the like weird things that to have happened was, like, you know, the idea that there was an anti-Brexit majority in that parliament managed to survive the literal fact of Boris Johnson's Brexit deal being passed at second reading by that parliament. But, you know, but there wasn't one. And so they had to get another. So that was the logic for it. obviously the resulting election went badly for Remainers in general and the Liberal Democrats in particular.
Yes, okay, thank you for reminding me of that. But I think the fact that I don't even remember what the logic was shows that I probably still agree with my position back then, which was, how on earth could you not want to keep Boris Johnson in this sort of dead man walking parliament? Although, as you say, that parliament and its makeup had passed that deal. But I did think maybe I was holding out some kind of false hope, like ill-founded hope because of the way that they acted, that the Remain voices in parliament would somehow work out a way of working together in order to either temper or stop what they'd already agreed to. But yes, I suppose only a new parliament could have helped that to happen. But I think the timing of it was really foolish, because it was near Christmas, it was horrible weather, we'd had all of these horrible votes and everyone was strung out and hadn't had any time off, and the public, as we know from the election result, were fatigued by it. And you were basically handing the electorate on a plate an escape from every time you turn on the radio, every time you turn on the TV, every time you get someone knocking on your door canvassing, talking about the same intractable issue, at a time when all you want to do is just have a break and have some time off work and be with your family over Christmas and not have arguments about this topic. So it was basically perfectly timed for Boris Johnson's purposes. And I just thought that it was really foolish. Everyone in the Labour Party and in the Lib Dems who thought that this was a good strategy, I just couldn't get my head around it. Because having him cling on over Christmas and into the new year perhaps could have helped the election result have some kind of different outcome. I don't know. This is a counterfactual and I don't know.
Well, I think this is the thing. I think that Stephen's argument, or Stephen's summary of the Liberal Democrat and SNP argument, that was the only way to stop Brexit, to get a more anti-Brexit majority, is right. But I think I think there are basically two problems with it, in that deal passed its second reading, but I can't remember what you call it, but like it basically, the timetable for according to which the bill would be voted on didn't pass, which gave Boris Johnson and his government this argument that Parliament was trying to stop Brexit when it had already passed, because they could have just suggested a new timetable, but they still did this mad charade of saying, oh, we have to go to the people because they're not going to let us get our Brexit deal through, when there was already a majority for it in that Parliament, as demonstrated by the second reading. So they basically allowed Boris Johnson and his government to pursue a disingenuous electoral strategy that Parliament was blocking Brexit when it actually wasn't really at that point. And so they kind of handed him an easy win in that way, when it wasn't really the case. And I actually do worry that history books are going to forget that it did pass at second reading, and when it was voted down, it was just because of the ludicrously short timetable that wouldn't have allowed for any debate. And if they brought a reasonable timetable, that would have passed as well. But then I think the second thing is that I'm not actually sure that just as those Remainers who wanted to prevent Brexit felt that they needed a stronger Remainer presence in Parliament to prevent Brexit, they also, I think, from Boris Johnson's perspective, I think he could have still struggled to get his deal through that current parliament, despite what I've just said. Because when you look at the people who voted for that bill at second reading, it was a very fragile coalition of the most ardent Brexiteers and Labour people who had eventually decided to vote for that deal. And I do think that as it had progressed through parliament and all the failings with it were exposed and debated, and it had more airtime in the media, that coalition for the deal would have fallen apart. And that would have been the opportunity for the people thinking that they wanted to stop Brexit. That would have been the time, really, to then, you know, hope to cobble on, you know, some sort of agreement for a second referendum or something. Like, that's still kind of pie in the sky. But given the thinking that they had around the election itself, I think that they underestimated the need for an election then, when they could have A, seen if the electoral coalition for the deal fell apart anyway, and secondly, they would have just left Boris Johnson in hot water for much longer.
So the interesting thing, and I'm aware I did this too, right, we forget that actually this gamble has worked brilliantly for one of the two parties that did it, right? the SNP had a fantastic election night. They defeated and unseated the Liberal Democrats' leader. They won a clear majority, you know, in every sense, right? They did incredibly well in that election in Scotland, and they played the campaign brilliantly. They started with their kind of let's get the core vote and the activists excited by talking about another referendum. And then they ended it in the final weeks being like, look, who is the biggest, strongest anti-conservative force in this country? You better believe it's us, the SNP. And so they got all of the kind of, you know, the most avid yes voters out on the doorstep, very excited. And then they managed to get soft no voters, remainers of pretty much every stripe. And that allowed them to make considerable gains and has finessed their big strategic argument. I guess this is where kind of the slight weirdness of this argument, we need to get onto the proper hypothetical, right, is that it exposes the central problem that remainers had in the last parliament, which is, what was the purpose of the 2019 general election? Was it to maximise the chances of staying in the EU? In which case, I thought then and still think now that the mistake was not going when they did, it was when they didn't go early enough. Because I think an election in which the Conservatives have been a party of no deal versus, yeah, like, I'm not saying revoke was a brilliant policy, but it certainly, the way people changed about it felt when it was deal versus revoke, then no deal versus revoke, let alone Labour's we'll have a softer Brexit and then you'll get a say on it kind of like muddled position. Everything else, the way it's perceived, is changed by the Conservatives doing what I did think Boris Johnson would always do, which is go, I don't give a flying one about Northern Ireland, let's just put a border in the Irish Sea. But it did work well for the SNP. I guess the question is so let's imagine that instead of them having an election, it passes at second reading. I've suddenly realised the thing that we don't know is, are we going to have a no-deal Brexit at the end of the year? Because I cannot conceive of a situation in which the last parliament would not have resulted in a no-deal Brexit. Because the one thing it could broadly agree on was that it wanted to leave, right? Whenever there was a vote on like the broad principle of Brexit, are you into it? The 2017 parliament would vote for it. Whenever it was like a flavour of Brexit, would you like any of those? So like, oh, no, no, no. And I think then you're right, Alva, then that anti-majority would have reasserted itself. But we would then have had a situation where, because there was no majority to take control of the executive, we would have just tumbled out. Of course, if we just tumble out now, then that hypothetical is a wash, I guess.
Yeah. But it's a really difficult hypothetical because I think it was a bad decision to have that election when it was had. And obviously for the SNP, it worked out well, but for the Lib Dems and the Labour Party, it didn't. But there were other factors as well that were at play, not just Brexit, that came up on the doorstep and that, you know, have been sort of immortalised in Labour's sort of post-mortem about their election performance. And we don't need to go over all of them now. But it's difficult to see those sort of extra Brexit factors changing the way that people were thinking much into the new year as well. It's hard to think about it playing out very or any differently if the election was postponed or there was no election, I suppose. Apart from the fact that it, you know, a big defeat gives a party the opportunity to change, which I suppose the Lib Dems and the Labour Party are grappling with the early stages of now. And you can argue how much of a blessing or a curse that is for a party. But, you know, just keeping those parties limping on while Boris Johnson, with, you know, no proper majority, started to implement his Brexit, you know, that probably wouldn't have been good for anyone. So maybe that election was a good idea because it's given them the chance to rejuvenate and renew.
Yeah, because the question I have, I struggle to work out what I think about this one. But, you know, from your journeys around the country during the election, those people who, you know, I think it's fair to say in every seat I went to, even the ones where quite visibly the Conservatives were going to win on a tide of Brexiteer votes, in every seat I went to, you met people who were saying, I have doubts about the Labour Party, but I want to stay in the EU.
Mm.
And, you know, I don't want to like rub salt in the wounds of the unemployed, but you can see this in the differential swings in that, like, you have seats which are equally leavey, but where the Labour candidate is themselves a leaver, and they do worse because they don't even benefit from any tactical Remainer voting.
Mm.
So the question I have is then, well, Boris Johnson clearly wanted, yeah, he was trying to commit kind of, you know, dissolution by Parliament, right? He was looking for a way out.
Yeah.
And that Parliament was never going to be able to agree on a finished flavour of Brexit. It could agree to leave, but it couldn't agree on any other specifics. Now, is an election in which the Conservative Party is arguing for a particular flavour of Brexit, in which those Remain tactical voters do not have a lever to pull to stay in, is that better or worse for the Labour Party in terms of the conversations you both had in the run up to that contest?
I mean, it's funny, Stephen, that you mentioned the Remainers who had their doubts about the Labour Party, because obviously those people existed and continue to exist. But I was kind of thinking about it the other way from the people who just wanted Brexit to happen. Mm. I think we've assumed in this conversation that if the election had happened slightly sooner, and as you say, Stephen, if the Conservatives had been the party of no deal rather than a party that had a deal to offer to the British people, that Remainer parties would have done better because they would have been the anti-no deal lever to pull. Whereas clearly the assumption among Conservatives from people like Dominic Cummings was that they at least needed to seem like they were gunning for no deal and that they were prepared to push the prorogation button, and that like that had to be the necessary context of the election, that they were being thwarted in their attempts to make Brexit happen. So I kind of feel like, I mean, it's like the big tactical question of like, is your number one goal to stop Brexit or to stop a Conservative majority or both? And in some cases, like they're inextricable, but in some cases they aren't. Because I think there's a case to be made that if the Lib Dems hadn't gone for that, Brexit could probably have happened. But in terms of how well the Conservatives did afterwards, all of the groundwork that they had been laying for months and months and months to fight an election campaign would just like have been completely scuppered. And maybe it would have been like, oh, well, we're the party that did deliver Brexit. But the kind of the whole framing of that election would have been so different if they had held off and would have had to like fight it on completely different issues. So, you know, I mean, for the people who were against Brexit within Labour, that would have been disastrous. Like tactically letting Brexit happen was the last thing they wanted. But for maybe more people within Labour, the thing was to prevent a Conservative majority that big. And maybe if the Lib Dems had held off in that regard, they would have seen a totally different outcome.
Yeah, it's interesting because you raise a really important point about what the Conservatives, because, you know, one of the many things I find amusing about like briefings from friends of Dom about that period is it's like, I'm old enough to remember when Dom Cummings was telling everyone who would listen that if they didn't leave by the 31st of October, the Conservatives' polling ratings would fall off a cliff and, you know, Jeremy Corbyn would take over the world, which is, among other things, why they behaved in the way they did in office, but also why Dom advised every MP who would listen and they should vote for May's deal at the third meaningful vote. Now, obviously, in the end, he turned out to be completely wrong about all of those things. But that doesn't mean that he would have been completely wrong about what would have happened, would have, if, as you say, the, like, energy of stop Brexit. And, yeah, I think it comes back to, like, the central thing of, like, what was the purpose of that election? If the purpose was to prevent a Conservative majority first and foremost, or at least to cap its size a bit, I guess it also comes, you know, back to, you know, to do some sort of BBC bashing, right? One of the factors of that election was the BBC covered Brexit very poorly, right? They didn't cover it in a detailed way. Would they have covered the policy trade-offs of probably three very different Brexit end states better? Because I think if you think they would have, then the election would probably have been quite different. But if you don't, then I just don't see how it would have been.
Yeah, I do. I think in an election where there's not so much clarity between the three Brexit positions of those parties, then you would have to, wouldn't you? Because otherwise, how are you going to represent each of the parties' positions at all, really? Because you've got to explain the differences between them. And if each of them gives a different vision for Brexit, rather than one of them saying revoke and one of them saying, let's have another referendum and then you can decide and on our version of a deal, and then one of them saying, we've got an oven-ready deal, you don't really have, you should, but you don't really have to analyse the contents of those three things because you can distinguish between them in a two-minute broadcast clip. Whereas if all three are saying, yes, we want Brexit, you know, we have our version of a Brexit deal, then you just explain the differences between the three. And even that is a little bit more explanation and a bit more scrutiny of those from a policy perspective.
Okay, yeah. So I think, okay, that actually possibly has convinced me that it was actually a definite disaster. Because, yeah, I think, like, someone in David Cameron's government once said to me, you know, like, they actually said, you know, they said, look, they said, the thing is, right, if you want an election to be about policy, they're like, you've really got to force the broadcasters to talk about policy, right? Mm-hmm. This was obviously in the context of wanting to, like, fight about, like, you know, we'll cut, they'll spend, right? And they were just like, so everything we do has to basically be about forcing them to have the argument about policy. And I think, yeah, you're right. Then if you had three flavours of Brexit, that would have, like, forced, in the same way that the Conservatives under Cameron did a brilliant job of forcing a conversation about policy, broadly by just being like, there was no space on cultural issues in 2015. There was no space on any other number of kind of like talkers, as it were, to a situation where the only things they were arguing about were parliamentary arithmetic and
yeah,
we'll cut, they'll spend. So yeah, I guess it was a disaster.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Alva Ray, my colleagues Stephen Bush and Anusha Kellyan. Our producer is Nick Hilton, and our music is Devil by the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.